Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. Joining us today in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Alex Keloff. He's running for Congress in the 3rd Congressional District, seeking the Democratic nomination. Alex, it's a pleasure to meet you. How are you today?
Good. Thanks a lot for having me, Chris.
You know, you entered this race early to challenge Congressman Jeff Hurd. Tell us why you got into this race. You got in early.
I did get in early. I got in at the end of April of last year, 2025. I got in early because I've never run for public office before. My whole 30 plus year career has been in business. And so I wanted to get in early. I wanted to establish name recognition. I knew it would be an uphill battle, but we've been at it now for almost 10 months, and I'm happy to say things are going really well.
You know, I want to get more into your background, get to know you a little bit more, and given your roots to the Valley, I want to tell us more about yourself and the Keloff family. And I'm going to assume he's your grandfather, George Keloff. I'm going to say that's your grandfather, but I might be wrong.
That was my great uncle.
Your great uncle. Okay, yeah. I'm sorry. Your great uncle,
right.
George
that's
Keloff. Right. We know
George
around here.
Was very well known.
Yeah.
As was his son.
So tell us about the Keloff family. Tell us about you, and tell us about, again, where you're at, and then how you got to this point.
Sure. No, I appreciate it. So my family on the Keloff side, my great grandfather and his three brothers, of which. So one of his brothers was George's father, immigrated to the district, specifically in Trinidad, in 1893. And like many immigrants at the time, they came to dig coal. Those were where the good jobs were. And then my grandfather was Joe Keloff. He was born in Aguilar in 1906. And he also dug coal for a while before going on with his cousin to start Keloff's Food Market. So probably many people in the Valley will remember Keloff's Food Markets, started in 1933 in a number of different towns across southern Colorado, all the way out east to La Plata. And my grandfather ran that for decades until my uncle Harold Keloff took over. And then Harold retired in early 2000s and sold the stores off at that point. So the stores ran for 70 years. My dad grew up in La Jara with my uncles, Harold and Dick Keloff.
Yeah, I really appreciate the history there on the Keloff family because, you know, if you grow up here in the Valley, you definitely know the name. You know the name of your relatives.
Well,
there.
And you mentioned George. So George had like the movie man,
right.
And Monty. And there were other family members that were in the Keloff family that had other businesses across the Valley. So general stores, theaters. There were theaters in Pueblo as well, Trinidad. So it was
you know the congressional district pretty well.
I do. Spent a lot of time here when I was young.
Let me ask you again, what compelled you, what made you say, ever run for public office, not something I've wanted to do or thought about, but I'm going to do this race. I'm going to get into the 3rd Congressional District race as a Democratic nominee, as a candidate. What pushes you to that point?
Yeah, the real impetus for deciding to run, actually even predating running, was when Donald Trump got reelected to office, I was concerned about the direction he would take the country. In my mind, all I had to do is see what he had said, what he had done, whether you look at January 6th or other actions that he took. And so I was very concerned about the direction he would take the country. Fast forward now, he took office about 13 months ago, and I look back at the last 12 months, I don't have a crystal ball, but I think it's been worse than I even anticipated. So when he was reelected, I decided I needed to get involved, as I mentioned earlier, never having been involved in politics. When I reflected on, well, how could I get involved? Does that look like volunteerism? Does that look like contributing to good candidates financially? I decided, you know, why don't I run? My values are informed by this district. I talked a little bit about my dad's side of the family. My mom went to high school in Grand Junction, and my grandfather, my mom's dad, was a small business person as well. He was a carpenter. He was a tile layer, worked on his own. So I feel like my values are very much informed from the district. I feel like I knew the district quite well. And so I said, why don't I run? And so I made the decision to throw my hat in the ring, probably, you know, without knowing much about it. But here we are, and it's going well so far.
You know, as you've traveled the 3rd Congressional in and out of the different towns, you have Pueblo, you have Grand Junction, we're talking about here in the San Luis Valley. What are you hearing? What are you hearing out there? over these past 10 months that has either reinforced your decision to get into the race or maybe questioned it?
Yeah. So a number of things, primarily, concern, with this administration's actions across the board, whether it's things like tariffs, which hurt our ag industry here and make the cost of living more expensive for everyone, not just Democrats, but Republicans alike. Obviously, ICE actions and some of the illegality that's gone on with some of the detainments, to say nothing of three Americans killed by ICE. And then deep disappointment with Representative Hurd, who voted for the One Big Beautiful Bill, that, of course, one of the key actions there guts Medicaid. And, of course, our rural hospitals are dependent on Medicaid because we live in these rural areas. And so a real deep disappointment. In fact, we ran our first poll 3 weeks ago, and Jeff Hurd's unfavorability rating came back at a negative net 40%. So he's deeply unpopular, and it's unpopularity based on the votes that he's taken, which have disproportionately hurt the constituents of the district. And they're aware of it.
So what gives you confidence that a Democrat can win the district? At this point in time, we've seen this race a few times where the sure. Democratic Party thought they had a shot at that seat.
Yeah.
Hasn't happened. What gives you some confidence that you're different this time?
So I think I'm the right candidate at the right time. With respect to the right time, I think there is going to be a blue wave like we saw in 2018. There's deep disappointment. There's worry. There's concern with this administration, again, for the number of illegal actions that this administration has taken, and also the chaos they've created using tariffs as an example again. And just deep disappointment in Jeff Hurd, who has really bent the knee to this administration. He made promises when he ran. He ran as a moderate Republican, or at least he styled himself that way. He made promises he would never support legislation that impacted health care in our district. He did just that. So I think it's incumbent upon me to hold him accountable and ensure that people know that the vote he's taken have hurt them. And I think, look, I think I'm the right candidate. I had success in business long before I decided to do this. I think I can bring that business acumen to benefit the constituents here in Washington. Chris, you and I talked before we started this a little bit about you've started this business. Congratulations on growing your business. As I mentioned, my grandfather, the Kellogg family, they were small business people for the last 130 years in the district. I think I understand how to build businesses. I've done that successfully myself. My family has done that for generations. We need to be creating good jobs, which will lower the cost of living and help everyone in the district. And that's what I'm here to do.
Let me ask you about a few hot button issues that are on the table right now with Congress, with the administration. The first one is the Trump administration's military buildup in Iran and whether you support or oppose a U.S. strike on Iran, as the president is again threatening.
I oppose a strike on Iran. That's not to say that I'm not realistic about Iran being a potential threat. There are actions they've taken that have harmed U.S. interests and killed U.S. personnel, particularly in Beirut in 1984. But I don't think that every problem needs to be solved by military action. And I think, quite honestly, I think part of this buildup is to cover up for the Epstein files, just like we did by going in and kidnapping Maduro. So while I believe in a strong U.S., I believe in our national defense, I think you shouldn't always use, not everything should be treated as a nail and using a hammer. We don't always need to use military action.
Let me ask you about technology. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission is taking claim that the federal government is what should regulate the prediction markets that we're seeing growing, right? Is that a federal responsibility, do you think? How would you see that as a member of Congress versus states and their ability to look at prediction markets like they do gambling?
Yeah. Well, certainly Nevada is against the federal government taking control there. It's not something I've spent a lot of time in. I could see, While you didn't ask the question, a lot's being talked about AI regulation as well, whether right. that should be federally regulated or left to the states. I believe in states' rights, but I also am a business person and understand if you have 50 different regulations, you know, managed by 50 different states, that can be unwieldy. And there are areas, AI probably more applicable than betting markets. As an aside, I don't like that we've created an environment where it's so easy to gamble. There was a long time where it was regulated to just or relegated to Las Vegas, and then we had state lotteries, and now we have prediction markets and the like. So I think there's a bigger question there, which is just we should ensure that prediction markets, while they have some utility and benefit, that people don't get addicted to them and, you know, just are gambling all the time.
Let's go down AI, that AI road.
Sure.
Are you saying that you think any governance of artificial intelligence, any rules there should come from the federal bureaucracy versus state legislature, should come through Congress versus state legislatures? Or how are you seeing artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I'm not completely steeped in the some of the laws that have been put forth that would regulate AI. So I'm a little out of my depth, but my sense is we do need blanket regulation on the development of AI. I believe AI could be an existential threat, but I also believe that there is a quote-unquote arms race with AI that we're competing with others like China that are putting massive resources and don't have the bureaucracy that we have. And, you know, for good reason we have that bureaucracy in our country. So I do think there needs to be probably at the federal level led about what regulation looks like for AI in this country. But it should absolutely incorporate states' views and thoughts on that. And so I'd like to see a balance there where we can come to an agreement and the states and the federal government can work together for smart policy.
Let's keep going and talking about federal rights, federal government versus
Colorado
state
River.
Rights. We go to the Colorado River Project, Colorado River Basin, and that compact.
Absolutely.
What would say to you that federal intervention, U.S. Interior intervention is needed, and or would you ever support federal intervention in the state compacts regulating the Colorado River itself? Where
That's
are you on that
a,
one?
Yeah, and I appreciate the question. It's so tricky, right? Because I don't want federal intervention. I don't support that. I would like to see the seven states that make up the compact come to an agreement. I'm a businessman. I, you know, negotiated many, many agreements. And I understand, I appreciate Colorado's perspective on it. And, you know, we're the headwaters of the river. So I think we do have more leverage in a negotiation than maybe down the lower basin states. But there are real concerns on both sides. And we see this winter has been a very dry winter. We're going to have massive problems. So we do need to reach an agreement. We all need to negotiate in good faith. I don't want to see federal intervention. I don't want to see particularly this administration, who, by the way, we all know what will happen if the feds intervene in the compact. They are going to punish Colorado, just like this administration has come after us for mail-in voting, moving Space Command, trying to free Tina Peters. So in this particular instance especially, I do not want federal intervention. I'd like to see the states come together and reach an agreement.
Are we in a political world where states, neighboring states, can even agree with each other on these types of issues that we don't need the federal government involved because states cannot agree with each other?
It's always, and I appreciate that, you know, each state is going to look out for its interests to a degree. I mean, but at the end of the day, we all share this resource, which is the Colorado River, to use this specific example. So we need to come together as not just, you know, the constituents of our states, but also Americans. Colorado River is critically important to our economy in Colorado for across agriculture, ranching, outdoor recreation. our livelihoods, many of us live here, like in the valley, because of things, the beautiful nature and things like the Colorado River. But we need to come together and come to reasonable agreement. Not everyone's going to get what they want, but we need to for the good of our states and the good of our country.
Some of those disagreements even get down to agricultural regions in the Colorado River Basin, the Upper Rio Grande River Basin, agricultural regions and their interests in maintaining crop production, in maintaining grasslands for alfalfa, for cow grazing, for sheep grazing. You have that side of the equation, and you have the equation of municipalities, the growing suburbs, the cities along the Colorado River Basin. How do you balance the interests of both constituents? Because I'm sure you're hearing from both constituents, municipalities who need the drinking water, ag regions, which are heavy in the 3rd Congressional, that need the irrigated water. How do you balance that in this climate that we're seeing and seeing change?
I mean, you know, Representative Hurd has worked on behalf of counties and other entities to ship our water to the Front Range. And that's just something I'm completely against. We need to keep our water in our district for the benefit of the people that live here, many of which you just, whether it's alfalfa farmers, you know, other ag and other ag entities, or the municipalities for drinking water and the like. So I am very much in support of, and this is something, you know, is almost non-negotiable for me. We need to keep our water in the district. We have use for that water. We're going to have another dry summer this year because of the low snowpack from this winter. And that's something that I believe we need to stand up for and is non-negotiable with respect to protecting and keeping our water in the district.
I don't know if you've seen, there was a newly released farm bill that they're starting to mark up, starting to look at. And I wonder, what would it take for you to, what do you want to see in the farm bill, in a new farm bill? What would it take for you to support the farm bill?
Sure. What I don't like to see is that we're actually exporting our water, right? Because much of that, those lower basin states that are taking water from the Colorado are used to irrigate large fields that are owned by Saudis, Russians, Chinese, other entities. So my concern about the farm bill as it's constituted today is it disproportionately supports large ag industry, not mom and pop farmers that this state, this district has been built on the back of for, you know, generations, if not centuries. And so I believe in supporting our local agricultural industry, but that's really the people that have lived here, have farmed the land, have ranched the land, not big international conglomerates that are just, you know, effectively exporting our water because they're using our water to grow their crops, and then the crops are typically going back to their own countries. So I would like a farm bill that's crafted to support and protect our farmers and ranchers here. But it should, look, we need to better utilize technology for productivity, for water usage, for retoiling the soil. And so there are things that I think we can incentivize in the bill itself to ensure that not just our industry survives, these industries survive, but they thrive.
You know, irrigated ag in the San Luis Valley and in the 3rd Congressional District is drying fast. It's going away in the valley, irrigated ag. We still have a good production, good level of production. When you think of irrigated ag, when you think of the water challenges we've been talking about, how do you get members of Congress, the country as a whole, to understand the problems of the West, the problems of the Rocky Mountain region, and what we're facing when it comes to a reduction, irrigated agriculture, fast drying climates, et cetera?
Yeah, I love that question. I got a similar question this morning in Crestone with a group of locals that got together there. And a woman asked me, what have I learned? What's the most important thing I've learned in running this campaign for almost 10 months? And I said, truly appreciating that rural areas like our district, I mean, sure, there's cities, Grand Junction, Pueblo, but most of the 53,000 square miles of across 27 counties is rural. That we, while we share many of the same concerns, many of the same priorities. We want to be able to raise our families, have our kids live out the American dream, you know, have affordable cost of living. Sometimes there are just true issues that affect us in rural areas. I'll give you the example that I spoke about a few minutes ago, rural healthcare. So Medicaid makes up somewhere between 60 and 80% of rural hospital budgets typically. Why? Because they're rural. And so they need these subsidies to survive. And what I was talking about earlier is like, you know, our communities, our ag communities, ranchers, farmers, they produce the food that go on the tables across America. In fact, I said, I know where groceries come from because the family was in the grocery business. And it's not the grocery store. It's the farms and ranches, right? Well, we need to protect those rural interests that make us different. And I think what happens in Congress too often is there's this belief that like we pass a monolithic bill and it's equally applicable to someone in, you know, New York City, Chicago, or Montrose, or the Valley here. And that's just not right. So I think as an elected congressperson, you have to fight for not just the values, but also the interests that are in sometimes different. And the last thing I'll say about that is, you know, one might disagree on Senator Lisa Murkowski from Alaska's policies. I don't agree with her in a lot of things as she's a Republican. But one thing I respect her for is during the one big ugly bill, negotiation, she's like, you don't have my vote. And they needed her vote to pass it. So she negotiated exclusions for her constituents in Alaska. Now, I don't love that because it's some handouts to special interest groups, but I respect the fact that she fought for her district, of which her district is rural, and sometimes you have to do that. So
it does feel like when you're looking at the world, when you're looking at the country as a whole, and you look at the topics and issues that are debated about the country, that these small towns, not just here in the 3rd Congressional and in Colorado, but small towns all over America, seem to not have a voice as loud as we're hearing from technocrats, from people who have influence, yes, because of their bank account, those types of things. I wonder how that part of the equation changes. Can it change what you bring to the table in that regard?
So as I mentioned earlier, you know, my background, my family's history is in small business, and small businesses are under attack, whether that's because they're overregulated and they, you know, there's regulations that's hard for them to keep up with, or they can't amortize the costs of running the business. Healthcare is a great example. Without universal healthcare, healthcare is costing small businesses so much money that it's hard for the small businesses to compete and stay in business. I mean, eventually my uncle decided to retire rather than try and compete with Kellogg's food markets against Walmart here in Alamosa and in other towns across the valley. I respect Walmart. Actually, I think they're a great employer. I think they do a lot of good for many communities. I actually spent a summer working for Walmart, so I can speak intelligently about that. But what we've gotten away from is small business formation that creates good local jobs where neighbors treat neighbors right. They treat everyone the same because they're customers. What I'd really like to see in Congress is a smarter tax code, more incentive for small business formation, which will lead to good jobs. And the other thing I'd say about that is my industry, my business was in telecommunications. We started a lot of small businesses that built physical infrastructure to deliver the internet to rural communities like this one. It creates good jobs. It creates good trades jobs. It's physical infrastructure we're building. And in this country, we've gotten away from investing in this critical infrastructure. So that my business was telecommunications, but we could talk about roads and bridges. We could talk about dams and reservoirs and pipelines and irrigation ditches. We could talk about affordable housing. These are critical investments historically the generations came before us made. We've gotten away from that. I think we need to make the investments in communities like this, in small businesses, remove the inertia and friction from creating those businesses, and I think they'll thrive.
Let me ask you, and we're going to wrap this up, but we really appreciate your time. Let me ask you a couple more things. Energy.
Yeah.
Power. What is the right energy mix for the country? What should that energy mix be now, given what we're experiencing with climate and the warming of this region in particularly? Sure. What's the energy mix that you would want to see?
Long-term, transparent transition to, you know, 100% clean energy. I don't know what the right time frame of that is. I know it's not 5 years. I know it's not 10 years. It's probably 50 years. So we have a demand for electricity in this country, some of which being driven by AI, as well as electrification of, you know, EV charging stations and the like, heat pumps that use more electricity. I think the right solution is an all of the above solution. We need to continue to incentivize clean energy, wind, solar, geothermal. I am a proponent of safe nuclear, but when you look at oil and coal, those are, you know, as a utility fuel, those are dying industries. The biggest problem that I have with this administration trying to keep open the Craig plant in Craig and then the Comanche plant in Pueblo, both of which are in the district, is I think it's so unfair to the miners, of which my family were coal miners, and the coal plant workers. They were told for the last 10 years that these plants were going to close on a definitive timeline. And then so they've made plans for themselves, and now the rug's pulled under them, out from under them. So I believe in all the above solution, but we need a long-term transition to a clean energy future.
What else are you hearing out there in the, as you're on the campaign trail, that we haven't talked about maybe? What else is resonating, or what else is on the minds of voters out there?
Rule of law. Rule of law, and the rule of law being under attack from this administration. I think people were rejoicing about the Supreme Court's decision to overturn the tariffs yesterday. They see that as a small win, but hopefully a win in the right direction. And then, you know, almost the number one thing, maybe that's number one, maybe number two, is a complete abrogation by Congress to stand up and fulfill its constitutional obligation as a co-equal branch of government, as the legislative branch of government. Unlawful executive orders, like overruling the law because it's in the power of Congress to form the laws and pass the laws. So those are the two things I hear most about.
We see a current standoff between funding for Department of Homeland Security because of what we're seeing from ICE. Where would your voice be in that conversation?
So I think, you know, some people are in favor of abolishing ICE, but we have to remember what the history of ICE was. It used to be called the Immigration and Naturalization Service. That was started in, I believe, 1933 or 1936. And then it was changed. The same responsibilities were given to a new department called ICE, but it was basically INS. So there is a need for an Immigration and Naturalization Service in this country. But what happened to the formation of ICE after September 11th in 2003 was each subsequent administration, you know, it gave it scope creep, mission creep. It took on more responsibilities, and now we have what we have now with the funding of, if you add up the funding for ICE and Customs and Border Patrol, you'd have the 15th largest military in the world. So it has gone way rampant. I am 100% in favor of the fact that we have a partial government shutdown right now over these 10 demands that Democrats have, no face coverings for ICE officers. They need to identify themselves. No unlawful search and seizure. These are reasonable things that many Republicans agree with as well. So what I'd like to see is a defunding of most of that budget that grew under this administration for ICE. And to the extent that it can't go towards more productive things like our rural hospitals, I'd like to see that funding go to local law enforcement who are better able to police their communities and keep the communities safe.
Hey, we really appreciate your time. You've been listening to the Valley Pod in our episode with 3rd Congressional District candidate Alex Kaloff. Colorado holds its Democratic and GOP primaries on June 30th. The Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods and is part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. See you around the Valley.
Thanks a lot, Chris. Thanks, Owen.